Welcome, counsel, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The case on our calendar today is 820-0510 Stephen Fisher we already heard that one. My apologies. The case we're hearing now is 820-0344 Kevin David Jonte, appellant versus Commissioner of Public Safety respondent. I am Tracy Smith. I'm presiding, and you can see you have Judges Connolly and Werke on the panel as well. Each of you has 15 minutes for your primary principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. The clock is showing in one of the rectangles. If you have any trouble seeing it, just let me know. But otherwise, we are ready to go. And when each of you starts your argument, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. We will begin with counsel for appellant. Go ahead.
Okay. Am I unmuted?
You are indeed.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. My name is Kent Marshall, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Kevin Jonte. We believe that the district court in this matter erred in two particular ways. First, the court failed to afford Mr. Jonte what I would phrase as passenger status, despite having made a finding that there was no evidence that he was the driver. This, we believe, resulted in a clearly erroneous finding that appellant was in physical control. Secondly, the court made a determination that none of the testimony that was offered at the implied consent hearing regarding things that were not known to the officers was relevant to the implied consent hearing. And again, we believe that this is clearly erroneous. Mr. Jonte is a lineman.
Counsel, can I frame this a little bit? It would help me understand, I think, for both counsel framing this to understand the rest of the case. The implied consent statute outlines the bases in which a revocation can be challenged. One of them is the lack of probable cause. But we also know from case law that it can be lack of that another basis for challenge is in fact not driving or not in physical control of the vehicle. So if you look at the case law, even though it's not listed in the statute, the fact of not actually driving or being in physical control is also a basis for challenging the revocation. Here, I find that things got a little confused here. It seems to me anyway, in looking at the record, because there's a petition that cites probable cause per the statute. It doesn't expressly say, well, my client's not in, the driver was not in physical control or driving. But then at the hearing, counsel Mr. Jonte says, essentially my client wasn't driving, so lack of probable cause for the arrest. That was a basis, I'm quoting now. My issue is whether or not my client was driving the vehicle. And then the court said, all right, so probable cause for the matter. Now we switched from actual driving physical to probable cause. Then we have this decision, and then that seems to turn on probable cause and not and evaluating that, which would be from the officer's perspective. And then goes on to say, but at the point where the officers are there, it also the decision also says, based on petitioner's close proximity to the vehicle, location of keys and ownership of the vehicle, it was more likely or not that petitioner was in physical control of the vehicle at that point. So the court seems to actually make a decision about physical control later, maybe not driving, but physical control. So I guess given all of that, and I want, does the opinion, no matter how confused I think it sort of was, the process here, does the opinion not find that based on proximity, location, and ownership, the petitioner was in physical control at that moment, and you have to, and why would that be clearly erroneous?
Well, I think it's clearly erroneous because the court failed to consider its own finding that he wasn't the driver, and it also fails to.
But can't he not have driven, yes, but be in physical control later? That's my question.
And I agree with Judge Smith. It seems to me we could believe your client completely. He didn't drive the car, she did. But at the moment the cops got there, the evidence could suggest that he was, by a preponderance, that he was in physical control. So who cares whether he drove the car before it stopped and ran out of gas. The question is, at the moment, you know, at that moment, he, you know, he could have gotten behind the wheel and, you know, if there was gas, off we go. So isn't that why, that's why, in my opinion, speaking for myself and not the panel, that's why I think you lose. Now, why am I wrong?
Well, I think that you're wrong because when you look at the case law, when the court is analyzing the factors, for instance, when the district court was analyzing the factors specifically on page 7 of its order, you know, the court said that he wasn't persuaded that either one of them was more likely to be in physical control than the other, save for the location of the keys. Well, if the court had afforded Mr. Jante passenger status, the case law tries to reward people who are passengers. It tries to protect people who are passengers. We know that he was a passenger because the district court found that he wasn't the driver. If he finds that he wasn't the driver, then he was the passenger. If we know that he was the passenger, then we know how the keys get to the ground. We know that the driver had to have put them there. And to simply disregard its own finding regarding that, I don't think matches up with what we find in State v. Fleck and in Januski and in Starfield. If we know that we have a passenger, then the law tends to protect the passenger.
Let me ask you a question, sir. At the time that the officer approached, would you agree that your client could have reached down, picked up the keys at his feet, gotten into the car, and fled?
Well, he couldn't have because the car was out of gas, but the answer is yes, he could have reached down, picked up the keys. That's true of any passenger. That is true of any passenger.
Well, then why don't you lose? I mean, you know, if he could have done that, he could have gone around the car, you know. I mean, theoretically, you know, she was in the back seat, so it's not like he had a pusher. You know, he could have gone around the car, got behind the steering wheel, put the keys in the ignition, and off we go. And I mean, I think, and I agree with you, you know, and Judge Smith, you know, I wasn't sure what was going on with the opinion. And it certainly would have been easier if the district court had actually made credibility determinations as to the people who testified, but you know, I guess the court just wasn't sure, but was sure of what the facts that were undisputed were. And so if as Judge Werke asked, if your client could have done that, I fail to see how he was not in physical control at the time. Even if he was a passenger, you know, before the car stopped.
The law simply cannot be that every passenger, every person who does the right thing by getting a ride, can't become in physical control if the driver bails. If we are not going to reward those people who do the right thing, if the law is going to punish them equally with those who do not do the right thing, then we aren't. We aren't doing what I think Fleck, Januski, and what those cases say. They say that we should protect passengers. And when you know the actual, when you absolutely know what went on here, then I think it becomes clear that all a driver has to do in order to get me in trouble is when law enforcement arrives, they can jump out and throw the keys on the floor of the passenger side, and then the court's going to find that I'm in physical control. That isn't what the implied consent law is supposed to do. The implied consent law is supposed to protect the public interest, and the public interest is to do the right thing. It's to find a designated driver. It's to refuse to drive when you've been consuming. This shouldn't be about, is there any way that we can make this stick to someone, whether or not they were driving and whether or not they were actually in physical control. To be able to throw the keys at someone's feet and then show up at the implied consent hearing and say, look, I lied. I was driving. I jumped in the back seat. I lied that I wasn't driving because I didn't want to get in trouble. Well, we know how the keys got to the ground. She threw them there because she's the driver. The passenger wouldn't have the keys. The driver would have the keys. I think that if the court had applied its own findings, and you know the court says I'm going to disregard everything that the officers didn't know. I'm not going to use anything that the officers didn't know. If the court had properly considered the testimony and then made a determination, as it really did, that the appellant was a passenger and not a driver, then when the court analyzed the other criteria, it would have had a different finding. There's no way that you couldn't have had a different finding. And that's my belief, that's my argument.
Thank you, counsel. It doesn't look like there are other questions. If you would like to just reserve your time for rebuttal, you'll have 5 minutes for that, but you're welcome to continue now. You have 4 more minutes.
Well, I think that the court has fairly well gone through my argument with its questions, but I was going to spend a little bit of time on this idea that the district court found that none of the testimony was relevant. And I think that, when we read Hansen v. Commissioner and Lona that was cited by the state, I mean, very clearly, the district court has to consider the testimony that is proffered at the time of the hearing. Otherwise, you wouldn't have those hearings. And if the district court didn't make a contrary finding here, the district court didn't make any credibility findings as was done in Lona, because there weren't any credibility issues. This district court found that this appellant was not a driver. But what he failed to do, what the judge failed to do, was then apply that finding to the status that should have been given to the appellant. He should have been found to be a passenger. When you make that application and then analyze the other factors, you come up with a different result. If the conduct of Mr. Jante is punished, then there's no passenger that can ever safely get into a vehicle when they've been drinking. Justice Potter Stewart said that in justice is really fairness. And what happened here isn't fair and it isn't just. We know what happened here. And to be able to try to find a way to make it stick just isn't the purpose behind the DUI statute or the implied consent law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, if you could state your name and the party you represent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nicholas Moen. I am here on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety, the respondent in this matter. Your Honors, I would first like to address the contention of the appellant that the district court made a finding that the appellant was a passenger only in this vehicle. That finding does not show up anywhere in the district court's order. What the district court does state in a paragraph beginning on the end of page 6 and on the top of page 7, quote, there's no reasonable basis to find petitioner was the driver of the vehicle. There's an analysis of the facts known to the officer when they arrived on the scene. And the district court ends the paragraph by saying, in short, there's simply no factual basis to fairly find petitioner was the driver. This, however, Your Honor, is Your Honor's, the statement simply means what it means, that the court didn't have enough information in its consideration to find affirmatively that the appellant was the driver. This is, however, not a statement that the appellant was not the driver, or a statement that the appellant was nothing more than a passenger. For that reason, I think it's clear that the district court did not make a determination that the appellant was only a passenger here.
Well, a couple things. Again, framing. Your brief, I think, treats this only as a probable cause issue and not the actual fact of driving or physical control. I think that's problematic because it sort of seems to me that to be a mixed bag, what was raised at the hearing and then also what the district court was talking about. The burden is on the driver to show, to prove one of the, is that right? The burden is on the driver to make the, to prove the facts that would justify revocation?
First, Your Honor, I would say, if you look at page 2 of the transcript, the court asked the appellant to narrow the issues. And at the bottom, his attorney says, essentially, my client wasn't driving, so lack of probable cause for the arrest. The court then, on the top of the next page, clarifies, all right, so probable cause for this matter.
Right. And the counsel also said, my issue is whether or not my client was driving the vehicle. That's at that same area of the transcript. But let's humor me for a moment and let's pretend that the issue of actual driving and physical control is a live issue in this case. Okay. And so I think what you're saying about driving is that the petitioner didn't satisfy you. You're reading the decision to say the petitioner, I guess, didn't satisfy his burden to show that he was not the driver. That's what you think the district court is saying about there's no evidence to show one way or the other. I mean, is that what you're trying to say about the language that you're quoting?
From the from the passenger, decision. Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes. My position is that the district court was not making a statement that the petitioner was a passenger or not the driver, simply that there was not enough information to determine affirmatively that the petitioner was the driver. The court then goes on to analyze it from a physical control perspective, and the court determines that there is probable cause that the appellant was in physical control. And in fact says,
was in physical control, not just probable cause, says based on the proximity, et cetera, court finds it more likely than not petitioner was in physical control. I'm looking at page 9 of the decision.
That is correct, Your Honor.
My question is, if let's say the court had considered all the evidence and had decided, made credibility determinations, decided that in fact the petitioner had not been driving the vehicle, was just a passenger, and that when the officers came upon it, he was standing, I think, at the passenger door. Someone else had been driving, and someone else, that driver apparently left, I don't know why the keys are on the ground. Why didn't he do the right thing then and being the passenger? Why should he, if in fact he had been a passenger and got a ride because he was not good to drive, why should he then be found in physical control at that time at the passenger door?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I would say there's not sufficient evidence that the appellant was simply a passenger or that Ms. Usselman was the driver. And I will answer—
Well, the court refused to make, it seemed to me, credibility determinations about that. There was evidence. It's just not decided because I think the court decided it wasn't relevant to the probable cause issue.
That is correct, Your Honor. The court stated that the testimony was not relevant and did not then proceed to make a credibility determination. The testimony, if the testimony that was not considered was believed and Ms. Usselman did in fact drive to the party, there is still insufficient information. There is no information in the record about how long they had been there, what had transpired entirely since the stalling of the vehicle. to say that just because someone drove a vehicle to a location, that cannot be construed to preclude that everyone else in that vehicle could not in any way take physical control of the vehicle after that point from the driver. I don't think there is case law supporting that. And I think that is why, even if actual physical control is considered as an issue, that the appellant would still have been in physical control of the vehicle at the time of the arrest and the officer's arrival.
So with that, it sounds like you're saying other people in the car, let's assume that there had been, you know, two other passengers. Could all of them then be in physical control and charged with the same, or have the same revocation of the driver's license then?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. No, I don't believe that is the case, or what the court is, the district court was trying to say here. But looking at the facts of this situation, the Ms. Usselman was in the vehicle. It was in her vehicle. The petitioner was outside with the keys at his feet. The appellant, in his argument, states that anyone there could have been in a position to grab the keys and start the vehicles. While hypothetically that is true, the keys were at the appellant's feet. The petitioner, or I'm sorry, Ms. Usselman was in the back seat of the vehicle inside. The appellant was the one with control over the keys and therefore control over the vehicle. The appellant said in his argument, anyone was in a position to just reach down and pick up
So the woman was just a smart criminal. Having been arrested for DUI before, she was smart enough to know, you know what? I'm not going to stay behind the driver's seat. I'm going to get in the back seat. I'm going to throw the keys out. And it is what it is. So we're here to, you know, I have some sympathy with Mr. Marshall's arguments that we seem to be punishing the wrong person. Am I wrong?
Your Honor, if Ms. Usselman was the driver and had immediately prior to the officer's arrest, hopped in the back seat and thrown the keys at the feet of the appellant before he had any time to react, then possibly your analysis would be correct. I don't believe that the facts or the record show that that is what happened. And again, none of this testimony was considered by the district court. And at the time of the officer's arrival, there was not any urgency or rapid movement. The appellant was standing there with the keys to his vehicle at his feet. He was in physical control of the vehicle. The appellant talked about the Hansen case.
No, feel free to stop there.
Very well, Your Honors. I have nothing further at this time. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to address them. If not, I would simply ask that the factual determinations and conclusions of law made by the district court be upheld in this matter. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, and I'll try to hurry, but the testimony should have been considered. That's the problem.
Well, what here about the testimony of the female at the scene? At the scene, she said, I wasn't driving, he was.
Well, I understand that, but she took
But that's what the police officer took into consideration too, right?
I agree. I agree. If this were a suppression motion, then I think that that's what we would look at.
So I guess if Mr. Jonte is looking for any silver lining or lesson, it would be if you're going to do the right thing and you're going to have a designated driver, by golly, you better make sure you have a designated driver that's going to say, yep, I was the one driving. That wasn't a question. It was a comment.
But the testimony, I agree, if it were a suppression issue, then we have a good faith exception and probable cause stands, but that isn't what we have here. We have someone under oath saying, I lied. I was afraid. I've been in trouble before. I have a DUI. I'm on probation. And so this is what I did. But I'm here to make it right now. I'm under oath. And I'm going to tell you, this is what happened. Now, the state is saying, well, we don't know how long they've been there, but we really do. If you look at the transcript, the home was about 6 or 7 miles away from where they left. We have testimony from Mr. Brenda Furr and Mr. Burmeister that they saw her drive away in the vehicle. They saw him as the passenger. We know that they drove past the house and then ran out of gas. So we're 7 or 8 minutes post leaving the party at the most. We also know from the transcript that Mr. Jante, when he got out of the vehicle, there was an emergency vehicle that went by, and he said, well, it doesn't look like they're going to help us. I'm going to walk down to the next intersection and see where we are so I can call for help. He walked down to the intersection. When he walked back, law enforcement is there. This is all uncontroverted. This is testimony. There is nothing controverted about that testimony. And if it had been considered, and it should have been considered, then I think we have a different outcome. Now,
I'm just glancing at the transcript. What does it tell us about then where you're saying that law enforcement is there when Mr. Jante approached the vehicle? Is that right? And where were the keys? Tell us what it says about the keys and how they got where they were.
Well, we don't know that until the officer testifies that he found the keys at Mr. Jante's feet or on the passenger side door. We know that from the officer said that that's where he found them. And so that, you know, that's the only thing that we know about that.
Mr. Jante didn't talk about the keys and neither did Ms. Usselman about how they got to be at his feet.
No, actually, you know, and I don't want to, I'm friends with the trial attorney. The question should have been asked of Ms. Usselman. Tell me how the keys got there. And then we wouldn't be here right now because that answer would have been, I put them there.
Mm-hmm. And was Mr. Jante, can you explain to me, because in terms of the approach, when the law enforcement is there, what does the record tell us about law enforcement being there and Mr. Jante coming to the car, or was he at the passenger door when law enforcement came? Can you just tell me what the record says?
I believe that the record is that he was, that he walked back from the intersection and that the deputy then had pulled up behind the vehicle by the time he got to the vehicle. Now, there was a second emergency vehicle that came by before Mr. Jante got out of the vehicle. He woke up when that vehicle went by and said, what's the trouble? She said, we're out of gas. He said, well, it doesn't look like they're going to help us. And so I'm going to walk down and find out where we are. And all of that's uncontroverted, but the district court failed to consider any of that testimony simply because it was not known to the officers at the time.
Okay. If you wanted to wrap up, you have 23 seconds, but otherwise
I think that does it. Thank you, Your Honors.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Thank you both for your briefing, your arguments today. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.